Turn with me in your Bibles to the book of Genesis, chapter 30. We left off in verse 25, and we're going to pick up there tonight. Genesis chapter 30, verse 25, reading on to the end of the chapter. Last time I referred to it as womb wars, as the wives of Jacob and Rachel, or Jacob, Rachel and Leah were basically dueling to see who could produce the most babies within the shortest period of time, how times change. And I call this womb wars do. Or number two, as we find it's a different kind of womb war that takes place between Laban and Jacob as they battle over their flocks. Would you stand with me as we begin in verse 25 and begin our reading of this section? It begins, "After Rachel gave birth to Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, 'Send me on my way so I can go back to my own land, my own homeland, and give me my wives and children for whom I have served you. And I will be on my way. You know how much work I've done for you.' But Laban said to him, 'If I have found favor in your eyes, please stay. I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you.' And he added, 'Name your wages and I will pay them.' Jacob said to him, 'You know how I have worked for you and how your livestock have fared under my care. The little you had before I came has increased greatly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. But now, when may I do something for my own household?' 'What shall I give you?' he asked. 'Don't give me anything,' Jacob replied. 'But if you will do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. Let me go through all your flocks today and remove from them every speckled or spotted sheep, every dark-colored lamb, every spotted and speckled goat. They will be my wages. And my honesty will testify for me in the future whenever you check on the wages you have paid me. Any goat in my possession that is not speckled or spotted, or any lamb that is not dark-colored, will be considered stolen.' 'Agreed,' said Laban. 'Let it be as you have said.' That same day, he, that is Laban, removed all the male goats that were streaked and spotted, and all the speckled and spotted female goats, all that had white on them, and all the dark-colored lambs, and he placed them in the care of his sons. And then he put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob continued to tend the rest of Laban's flocks. Jacob, however, took fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees, and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. And then he placed the peeled bark in all the watering troughs so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. And Jacob set apart the young of the flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streaked and dark-colored animals that belonged to Laban. And thus he made separate flocks for himself and did not put them with Laban's animals. Whenever the stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches in the trough in front of the animals so they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak, he would not place them there. So the weak animals went to Laban, the strong ones went to Jacob. And in this way the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and donkeys." Let's begin with prayer. Father, we ask that you would guide us and lead us in our study of your word tonight, that you would open its truths to our hearts and minds, and that, Lord, we might learn precious truths that could guide us in our walk with you. We pray for this blessing in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated. Verse 25, as we can see, is sort of a segue between these two sets of womb wars that I'm describing. As I mentioned before, the first kind of womb war that was between the wives of Jacob over who could produce the most children, and then now over between Jacob and Laban over who could produce the largest number of flocks. If you recall, for 14 years, Jacob had worked for Laban, tending his herds. 7 years he labored in order to marry Rachel, only to have Laban switch women on him, and discovering afterwards that he was actually married to his other daughter, Leah. So he labored 7 more years for the right to marry Rachel, who was his first and dearest love. During those 14 years, God had really begun to reveal his blessing upon the life of Jacob, as he had promised. 12 children are born to him during this period. 11 boys, one daughter. Eventually, a 12th son will be born to him, becoming the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel. But from these two wives, Rachel and Leah, and their two servant girls, God richly blesses him. And in a sense, in the eyes of the Middle Eastern culture, children are the greatest treasure, the greatest wealth that a man can have, and they are certainly viewed as evidences of God's blessing upon your life. But beyond many children, Jacob had remained virtually penniless. Remember, when he came, Isaac had not given him any inheritance or any money. He just went on the journey by himself. He arrived at Laban's house without anything, and now virtually had served as a slave for 14 years, receiving only food and shelter and two wives and a whole bunch of kids. But other than that, he had nothing, not a single sheep or goat that was his own personal property. Everything belonged to Laban. That's why in our reading it begins with this request in verse 25. He said, "Send me on my way so I can go back to my own homeland. Give me my wives and children for whom I have served you, and I will be on my way. You know how much work I have done for you." Jacob's request really kind of sets up, I think, one of the more interesting contests that we find in the biblical record. You see, by now Jacob had no doubt about the character of his uncle Laban and what his intentions were really like. I mean, Laban is clearly a dishonest man, at least in the way that, frankly, most men, when they're dishonest, tend to be dishonest. In other words, very few men are openly deceptive. I mean, most crooked and deceitful people who rob don't stick a gun in your side and say, "Give me your money," although there seems like that number is increasing. But generally, that's not how we steal from each other. We're much more clever in how we go about it. He's not openly deceptive. Rather, he relies upon craft and cunning. It's really kind of the fine print of the contract, if you will. It's not so much what is stated, but what is not stated. It's almost like when you hear somebody defending themselves when they're accused of some kind of criminal offense, and they say, "Well, according to the letter of the law, I did nothing illegal." When somebody says something like that, "according to the letter of the law," you know that they're not an honest person. Because by the letter of the law, you can get away with just about anything. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, lawyers are always trying to reinterpret the fine points of the law to come up with novel interpretations that often are not within the parameters of the original intent of the law. So if you want to have a law-abiding culture, you have to have people who are law-abiding in their heart. If you want to deal with somebody who is truthful, you have to have somebody who in their heart values truth and honesty, and so that your confidence is that if you turn your back, they're not going to cheat you. It was interesting talking with one of our vets coming back from Iraq. He said, it's so interesting in Iraqi culture, he said, even under Saddam Hussein, that all of the major banking and financial institutions were headed up by Christians. And he said, because even in that culture, the Christians had the reputation of being the ones who were honest. They were the ones who could be trusted. So they entrusted that to him. In fact, I was talking with Tim Olson today about we were talking about the biker clubs and stuff. And he said one of the things that when they get together in these groups with a lot of the outlaw bikers always want them to watch all the valuables. Because they said, they know we won't steal it. The rest of their brethren, well, they're outlaws. I mean, that's what they do, you know. And so there's no honor in that between them. And so what you find out is that either a person is an individual of integrity on the inside, or else they're not. And when they have to always say, "I swear upon a stack of Bibles," well, all I can say is watch out. Because Jesus said we should be people who are known by letting our yes be yes and letting our no be no. Even Psalm said, even if it works to our own disadvantage, he says, "Blessed is the man who swears to his own hurt and doesn't change." In other words, I promise I'd do something and I realize, wow, why did I make that commitment? But Jesus says, but keep the commitment anyway, because what's more important than your time or your money or your inconvenience is that your word become known as one that can be trusted and relied upon. It's one of those things that's not recognized today in the litigious society that we live, where lawyers suddenly can twist and craft a conversation or an event in such a way that what was said is no longer what was said, or what was agreed to is no longer what was agreed to. But Jesus said that one of the things that will mark out the people of God is that we won't play that game. We'll be a people who will be set apart by the decisions we make, the way we make our choices. Don't become a Laban. Because one of the things that's interesting about Laban is he's a guy who would say, well, I'm a follower of God. We'll see, in fact, that he is a quote-unquote religious man. But is he an honest man? And if you're not an honest man, then the scriptures say your religion is empty and meaningless. It has no impact. What makes our religious profession have impact is the fact that it bears a parallel to the choices and the way that we live our lives. Well, Laban, again, is one of these guys. He's shrewd and he's clever. We see twice he structured these agreements with Jacob that were designed to really advantage him at Jacob's expense. But now Jacob's value to Laban has grown to such a degree that he dare not let him go. In fact, verse 27, it says, but Laban said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, please stay. Well, here's the problem. He hadn't found favor in Jacob's eyes. Jacob had his number. You're not a nice guy. You're not my friend. You don't care about me. So it's kind of an interesting way of putting it. He says, but I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. He added, name your wages. I will pay them. So Jacob said to him, you know how I have worked for you and how your livestock have fared under my care. In other words, you know my integrity. You know the integrity of my behavior. The little you had before I came has increased greatly. The Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. But now, when may I do something for my own household? In other words, Jacob is coming to a reasonable point of responsibility. I have 12 kids now. And I have responsibility to be able to care for them. And see, here's part of the problem. When Laban dies, everything he has goes to his kids. Nothing would have gone to Jacob. He would have received nothing. All of Laban's sons would have received all of his properties. And so Jacob would have been left with absolutely nothing. Now, what exactly Laban means by this term divination isn't completely clear, even in the lexicon, because in most places where it's used in the Old Testament, it refers to occult or pagan practices, and by that we mean the attempting to foretell the future or discovering the unknown through omens or oracles or supernatural powers. Something that, in fact, is clearly condemned later on in the Old Testament. For example, Leviticus 19:26 says, do not practice divination or sorcery. Or Deuteronomy 18:10 goes into more detail. He said, there shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire, in other words, sacrificing your children, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or who conjures up spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. Essentially, the reason we're told this in the Old Testament particularly is because all of this really represented a form of demonology or demon worship. Since they were not God's voice that would be speaking to them or communicating to them the information that they would gain through these things. And that's why the Amplified renders the passage this way. He said, for I have learned by experience and from the omens in divination that the Lord has favored me with blessings on your account. In other words, what is clear by this statement is that Laban obviously is a guy who practices religion. We could call him a religious man. But not in the same sense that Abraham and Isaac were religious men. And this is always the challenge in the world of religions, even in the world of Christianity. There are many people who profess to be followers of Christ. But does that really make them truly Christians? I thought it was interesting when listening to the reports about the girlfriend of Scott Peterson, Amber Fry, and how she shared how that she had given him a copy of this book, The Purpose-Driven Life, to read. And I thought, well, that's fascinating because, I mean, I'm looking at her life and it's probably purpose-driven, but not by the same purpose that I'm driven by. And it was just interesting to me, but here's a person who really I don't think is a Christian. I may be judgmental, but I don't see the fruits of that in her life. She doesn't go to church. She never accepted Christ, you know, so forth and so on. And yet she's engaging in this religious activity. And we see this all over our culture today. We watch the gangster rapper standing at the Grammys going, I want to thank my God for blessing me. You know, and we're just kind of going, whoa, yo. Anyway, I mean... Homie or Homer or whatever it is. The bottom line is, you know, I mean, I'm just going, this is pretty dissonant information, you know, that you're looking at. If you ever watch the video and then you watch the Grammy, they show the video and then they show them getting a Grammy and then they thank God for the video and the Grammy. And you're just going, this doesn't add up, you know. This is kind of like when I was in school, we had new math, you know, somehow 4 + 4 always came out to 5. I could never figure out how they got that. But anyway, that's really as crazy as it is, and that's what we see many times, where people who profess this religious devotion, and if it confuses you, you got to understand how much more confusing it is to the non-Christian out there. If it's confusing to you, think about how confusing it is to the non-Christian. Because many times what we view in our culture today is religious persecution. You know, people making laws or ruling things or firing people because of they don't honor people's religious values and something is not necessarily intended by those people to be persecution. It's simply that they have become so removed from any understanding of what biblical Christianity is that they just don't get it. They don't understand why we have problems with certain things. Why aren't we more tolerant of people? What's wrong if two people love each other and want to live together, even if they're two guys or two gals, if they love, and they really, you know, buy into this whole way of thinking and understand, why are you guys so intolerant? And you have to understand is they're not trying to pick on us. They're not running around trying to make our lives miserable. In fact, they would say, why are you making our lives miserable? What's the problem here? The fact is they have a form of godliness, Paul said, but they don't know its power. They have certain kind of religious symbols. They wear the crosses around their neck. Of course, they're studded with gold and silver, but nonetheless, they wear these around their neck and they may say, God bless you, and you know, all those sort of things, but they know nothing of whereof they speak. They have no experiential level. And when you look at a guy like Laban, who is deceitful and dishonest and cunning and shrewd and is really driven by his own material desires for prosperity, and yet he turns around and says, God has revealed to me that you're blessed of God and I become blessed because of you. And we can easily say, well, he must be a spiritual man. And maybe he is spiritual, but it's not the same spirit. He doesn't understand who we are, who we worship. And as a consequence, he's following some other religious form. Now, it's impossible to know exactly where Laban fit into the religious spectrum. But in their day, there was really kind of three categories in which a person could fall in terms of views of God. There was, first of all, what we call polytheism, the idea that there are many gods. The Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians, the Babylonians were basically polytheists. They had multiple gods. They had a whole panoply of gods. They had a hierarchy. They had the head god, and then they had sub-gods underneath them. And basically, they interacted amongst themselves much like human beings, but they therefore would have many idols and many altars of worship because there were many gods. Remember when Paul goes to Athens and he says, I saw in your city that there was, that you are very religious people and you had one altar that said an altar to the unknown God. In other words, just in case we miss somebody, we just got an altar available to sacrifice to whoever we didn't get. Because then there's all these gods out there. That's what polytheism teaches. Now, there's another form called henotheism that is less well known. Henotheism believes that there are many gods, but I only worship one. In other words, each nation or each family had its own personal god. And it's interesting, one of the things you see in the study of the nation of Israel, there were periods in Israel's history where this is where the Israelites are. They would talk about the God of Israel, but they believed their God was in competition with other gods. And so the idea was, well, we worship the God of Israel because we're Israelites, and you worship this God because you're whatever you are. And they didn't recognize what monotheism teaches. And that's really what we have to make a distinction. Monotheism means there is one true God, and all other gods are non-gods and false gods. You see, even though the term gods, there are gods, many may be used at times, the idea is that they are not truly gods. They may be spiritual, but they are not gods. And so when they worshiped idols, it said in Deuteronomy, Moses said, you are worshiping demons. So that when they're worshiping a demon, what are they worshiping? Well, most scholars think they were worshiping fallen angels, angelic personages who represented themselves with spiritual power and spiritual presence. In fact, Paul said they can appear as an angel of light. They can appear as being actually from God. And he says, but they are not really God. They just seek to induce men to believe that they are God and to worship them. Because in the final analysis, there is only one true God, who is the ultimate creator, the ultimate judge or arbiter of all men's affair. He is the only one who is totally and absolutely morally pure. And this is why, if you're a follower of God, a true follower of God, part of the pursuit of your life becomes moral purity. I mean, the idea of striving to be honest and truthful and faithful and with restraining yourself from things that God says thou shalt not is really grows out of a desire to want to be in alignment and in fellowship with who God is. John put it this way in his first letter to the church. He said in chapter 2 that any man who says that he is a follower of Christ will walk or live his life as he lived his life. In other words, if I'm truly following Christ, what does that mean? It means I follow him. You know, it's kind of like when somebody says, well, I'll follow, you lead and I'll follow, and you turn around and they're someplace else. You turn around and say, you're not following me. And they say, oh, yes, I am. I'm just following you someplace else. Wait a minute. That's nonsense. If you're following me, it means that you're following me, you know? It's like the old cartoon, walk this way, you know? You know, it's that idea that if you're going to walk this way, you're going to walk the way I'm walking. So that if I say I'm a follower and yet I'm taking a completely different path, isn't it a valid question to say, are you really a follower? Because if you're not following, then you're not a follower. This seems so simple, I'm beginning to feel stupid even saying it. It's even more embarrassing. I wonder, why do I even have to say it? Why do we live in an age where you have to say this to people? And when they hear it, they're going to go, wow, you know, I never thought about that before. Well, it's like I always say, sin makes you stupid. It really does. You may think you're pretty sharp. One thing I've learned from experience, if I let sin take over my thought life, I do and say some stupid things that I later regret. And that's essentially the power of sin. But the simple truth of it is, you can tell, Jesus put it this way, judge the tree by its fruit. If the root is good, the fruit is good. If the root is bad, the fruit is bad. Man, that is simple, isn't it? I mean, you don't have to take a course in agriculture to figure that one out. Most of us have got that far. And the long and the short of it is, when I see fruit in my life that's not good, you know what it tells me? There's something wrong on the interior of my life. When I begin to say things that are not really like Jesus said, you know, in other words, there's kind of these, it's really interesting age we live in. There is this movement in the church today, if it be in the church, where you've got, you know, Christians are trying to be relevant and really relate to the culture. And so they use profanity, even from the pulpit. You know, the pastor will get up there and use curse words. And this is supposed to be kind of relating and relevant, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I think to myself, can you picture Jesus using four-letter words to communicate? You know, generally we have come to find that people who use profanity do so because they have a very bad vocabulary, a weak vocabulary, so they're filling in the blanks with profanities that don't really fit the sentence, you know. If you diagram it, you don't know where to put that in the diagram. Anyway, but the bottom line is that it's an indication of a disconnection from this idea of being a follower. Because if I follow Christ, would I do that? You know, the little adage that goes all the way back to In His Steps by Charles Sheldon, written back in the middle of the 19th century sometime, 1880s or sometime like that. And you know, the subtitle of the book, which ended up as recently as a bracelet again, was "What Would Jesus Do?" What would Jesus do? And it's a great reminder, I think. How would Jesus deal with this situation? Now, sometimes people answer that question wrong because they don't know the Bible well enough. I mean, really, I hate to say that, because some people, because they don't know the scriptures, they say, well, what would Jesus do? Well, I think Jesus, and they may go off on some weird tangent, which usually when you make a bad choice like that, you get beat up in an alley someplace. But the bottom line is, what would Jesus do? And it really becomes this idea that if I'm a follower, then I find that my steps tend to fall into where he has stepped before me. And I begin to relate to people and situations in a way that's really consistent with his attitude and his heart. Well, so I think you get my point. I don't think Laban was really a follower. The very fact that he practices divination implies that he's really not a true worshiper of God. And for a couple of reasons. Essentially, when one uses such means to communicate with God, it ends up usually that it's not God that they're speaking to. Instead, they end up communicating with demons. You know, I think about people who play Ouija boards or go to palm readers or who check the newspaper for their astrological chart and all the rest of that kind of stuff. You know, even if you get information that is useful, it's important to understand that this is not the channel that God says he's going to speak to men. In fact, scriptures make it very clear that I do not talk to you through those channels. You know, that's not the avenue through which I address people. And therefore, that should be a good tip to us that this is not something that is valid. And so, you know, I just think it's really kind of unfortunate and often misleading when I run into Christians who believe in astrological charts or who go to soothsayers or people who, you know, they want to, you know, go visit Jay-Z Knight and have Rampa speak to them. I'm a 4,000-year-old baby. I mean, and, you know, get some kind of insight on their life. But there's a greater reason why that's not a good idea. Aside from the fact that the communicator may not be God, there's something more central to a problem in you if you rely upon those kind of things to kind of get guidance for your life. You see, when people do this, their problem isn't that they simply desire to know what the future is. We all want to know what the future holds. We'd all like to have an inside angle on what's going to happen tomorrow. There's a certain natural curiosity that's there. That's not really the problem. The problem is why we want to know it. And the reason we want to know it is so that we can control our future. So I can control. I mean, in other words, what am I going to do with that information? If I know what tomorrow holds, even though the Bible makes it clear, very clear that you won't and can't know what tomorrow holds. No man knows what tomorrow brings, the Bible says. So even though we can't know it, the desire to know it, what would I do with the information if I did? It's almost the assumption that somehow this would be of a benefit to me so that I could structure my choices to advance my personal agenda the farthest I could go. Basically, it's a desire to see what only God can see so that I can live only as God lives, and that is after my own will. Remember what Eve's sin was? Serpent said to her, God's holding out on you. He doesn't want you to eat the knowledge of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because then you will become like God. And the desire to become like God grew in her so that she went and transgressed the word of God. The desire for self-deification, self-glorification is powerful inside the heart of men and women. And so this idea of if I could only know what the future holds, then I could design my life to take advantage of that information. You know, how many of us saw that series of movies, Back to the Future? And how many wished we could have gone into the future with that book and bet on those games like that guy did, you know? I can't remember the character. I mean, where do those kind of ideas come from? It comes from the hearts of men who think, if I could just know what the future held, then I could use that, I could manipulate that to advance myself. And yet, what does it mean to be a follower? It means that I've relinquished any claims to self-design over my life. I say what Jesus said. If I'm following Jesus, what do? I pray the thing that he prays. Father, not my will, but your will be done. Or when his disciples said, Lord, teach us how to pray. He says, this is how you pray. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In other words, the whole idea of being a follower is saying, Lord, I've relinquished my right to create my own path. And instead I've said, Lord, I want to know the path that you have for my life. I want to know what your will is. Well, even further evidence that Laban's insight into Jacob's favored status was not from the Lord, but was really from another evil source, is what he does with the information that he has. He gets this information through observation, possibly, maybe through some divine omen. You know, in those days, they do like, I don't know if they did in this days, but the Romans used to cut open birds and look at their livers and draw conclusions based upon what they saw there. You know, some way he came up to this conclusion that God, this blessing, this enrichment coming to my life is because Jacob is living in my house. But you see, the reason we know it was an evil source is because it leads him to an evil behavior. He concludes that he has to do everything in his power to keep Jacob under his power. One of the things I have found is that good, effective, even great leaders become that because they are surrounded by good, effective, and sometimes even great support people. I mean, just as Laban became enriched by Jacob's service, so many times in the business world or in government or even in ministry, these organizations greatly prosper because there is a team of people whom the Lord simply has brought together. I thought it was really interesting watching the progress of the Sonics this last season because they started out not terribly successful as a basketball team. And then early on in the season, they got into a situation where they couldn't fly, and so they had to go on a very extended bus trip together. And they were, you know, delayed and spent a lot of time together, and they ended up playing cards and talking and visiting and get to know each other. And something happened in those, like, 48-hour period. They got to know each other as people. They began to bond as friends. And from that point on, they played completely differently than they had previously. They began to play as a team. And what happened is they began to win. And something you know about athletics is great teams rarely are great teams because they have great individual players. They become great teams because they play like a team. Each one is willing to, you know, give up the lead to the one who is stronger in that area than they are. And they work together in this sense of community, this sense of unity. And whenever you see anything that's successful, you begin to realize what you have is a group of people who have really submitted themselves not just to one another, but to the objective that they are seeking to accomplish, because the objective becomes more important than themselves. So in the same way that Laban had become enriched by Jacob's selfless, honest integrity of service towards him, so also we find that businesses or government or ministry succeed as well. And successful leaders are the first to realize the key to their success is people around them who will help them become successful. But the danger for successful leaders is to either become threatened or to become possessive of those people and their abilities. Many times I've seen leaders become threatened by the talents of people who work under them, or else they try to control and hang on to them. But you see, being in a role of leadership is not about climbing to the top of the hill and then once you get there, holding off anybody who might try to take your place. Rather, it's finding ways to promote those who are under you to achieve even greater success than you achieved. I mean, Jesus said as much. He said to his disciples, "You will do greater things than I have done." I mean, it's an amazing statement. I puzzled over that for years, and I see the whole point now. Jesus is saying, if you yield to the Father as I'm yield to the Father, there's no reason why the Father can't do in you and through you what he has done through me, and you will do it 100 times over, 1,000,000 times over. What I often tell pastors is that their objective is to work themselves out of a job, to train up and equip others who will take their place one day. And there's a kind of genius in what people might say is madness. Because I found that the only truly indispensable people in any organization are people who are so good in letting other people grow up and mature that they become indispensable. Because it's easy to find people who can be trained to do a task. It is very difficult to find people who can train other people to do the task. Some of the most, I have one pastor friend of mine I know that I just admire him because he has this incredible ability to identify young men and women who have a real giftedness and calling on their life and then to facilitate them. He's not a great teacher himself, but man, he has this ability to disciple and train and really put these people into places of influence where they become many times much better Bible teachers and communicators and evangelists than he is. But it's a unique ability, and as a result, God is continually blessing and raising him up. You see, great men are those who leave a legacy that is really a legacy of greater men than themselves. In fact, one of the ways I saw this illustrated is a story somebody sent to me one time. It went this way. It says, a gentleman by the name of Edward Kimball had a burden for one of his Sunday school students to know Jesus as Lord and Savior. He went to see him where he worked and led him to Christ in that shoe store. The young man's name was Dwight L. Moody, who went on to become an evangelist whose ministry rocked two continents. While preaching in the British Isles, Moody spoke in a small chapel pastored by Frederick Brotherton Meyer. In his sermon, Moody told an emotionally charged story of a Sunday school teacher he knew who personally went to every student in his class and won them to Christ. The message changed Pastor Meyer's entire ministry, inspiring him to become an evangelist. Over the years, Meyer came to America several times to preach, once in Northfield, Massachusetts. A confused young preacher sitting in the back row heard Meyer say, quote, if you are not willing to give everything to God, are you willing to be made willing? That remark led J. Wilbur Chapman to accept the call of God in his life. Chapman went on to become one of the most effective evangelists of his time. A volunteer helped set Chapman's crusades and learned to preach by watching him. Who was the volunteer? His name? Billy Sunday. Sunday eventually took over Chapman's ministry, becoming one of the most effective evangelists of the 20th century. In the great arenas of the nation, Billy Sunday's preaching turned millions to Christ. Inspired by a 1924 Billy Sunday crusade in Charlotte, North Carolina, a committee of Christians committed themselves to reach that city for Christ. They invited Mordecai Ham to hold a series of evangelistic meetings in 1932. A lanky 16-year-old sat in the huge crowd one evening, spellbound by the message of the white-haired preacher who seemed to be shouting and waving his long finger directly at him. Night after night, the youth attended and finally went forward and gave his life to Christ. The teenager's name? Billy Graham. Billy Graham has doubtlessly communicated the gospel of Jesus Christ to more people than anyone else in the history of the world. Now, here's the perspective we need to have. What was Edward Kimball's legacy? It's Billy Graham. Because he is that part of that chain which led to this future legacy. In other words, when we cling to power or cling to position or cling to our authority, it's not only a godless behavior, it's a useless behavior. It's like grasping sand in your hand. You know, if you take a handful of sand and you hold it loosely, you can pretty much hold on to most of it. But if you begin to squeeze it and close your fingers around it, most of it will be lost until eventually there's only a few grains of sand left in your hand. The tighter you grip, the more you lose. Or as Paul would say in Hebrews 12:1, when he said, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. When I was a young Christian, I read that and thought, running the race. Yes, I'm going to run the race for God. And you know what I did? I began to become a sprinter for God. I mean, to me, it was like, I'm going to run and I'm going to cross that line before anybody. Or to put it in ministerial terms, I'm going to be the best preacher with the biggest crowd and the biggest church, and I'm going to just do great things for God. But as the years pass, I don't know if it's wisdom or fatigue that takes over. You realize that you can't sprint all the time, and you begin to realize this isn't just a 100-meter run. This is a marathon. You know that Jesus didn't come back within 2 years as I had been promised after I got saved. And so here 35 years later, you realize, you know, you got to kind of pace yourself because you're going to be running this race maybe till the day that you die. And so you begin to run it like a marathon. But even more recently, as I began to contemplate the fact that I am in the closing chapters of my lifetime on this planet. We don't like to think of ourselves in those terms, but it's a simple factual reality. Most of my life has been lived. You know, you call, when people reach 50, they say, well, I'm middle-aged. Well, how many of us are going to live to be 100? That's not middle-aged. You're in the back nine now, you know. You're getting close to the clubhouse. You know, let's just face the facts. And as you come to those closing chapters of your life, I came to suddenly realize it's not a sprint. It's not a marathon. It's a relay. It's a relay. And you know what the key to the relay is? It's not the guy who can run the fastest. It's the man who does the best job of passing the baton to the next runner. I don't know if you ever were involved in track, but you know, track meets, I mean, relays are won and lost by the pass of the baton. More great teams have been way out in front, and a bad pass caused the baton to be dropped, and they lost the race. And you see, what we have to understand is that there comes a point where we need to be thinking in terms of, if the Lord does not come in my lifetime, then will I be able to say I was faithful in passing the baton on to the next generation? You know, let me rebuke some of us older people here. You know, by older, I mean over 40s. We need to kind of step back and look at things a little bit more objectively. Sometimes when we think about the structure of the church or the focus of the church or what goes on in the church, we think in terms of how does it meet my needs? Now, that's not totally invalid, you know, because, you know, church should not be a place where you're horribly uncomfortable. But at the same time, many times we become so focused upon the church being an organ of ministry to me that we don't think in terms of what are we doing as a church to reach the next generation. What are we doing to really pass that baton on to not just our own children, which we do a bad enough job as it is, but what do we do to all the young people who are growing up in our world? Are we really focused upon reaching them and seeing them take the baton of faith and carrying it on to their generation? Because every great movement of God has died in the second generation. Because in the second or third generation, they failed to pass the baton on to those who are coming up after them. And I think it's one of those things that we need to really kind of seriously weigh in our hearts. Because we'll end up being like a Laban. Because once he tries to hold on to something he can't hold on to, and once Jacob is gone, Jacob takes all of the wealth that God had given him. You think about it, if Laban had a different plan. If Laban had just simply said, you know what, God has blessed me so much, I'm going to give you half of everything I have is yours. You take it. What do you think would have been the consequence? Well, first of all, Laban would have ended up with more than he had. He would have ended up with a lot more than he had. He probably also would have been blessed by God, because I have found that God blesses generosity. I mean, I don't know about you, but my wife and I have discovered you just can't outgive God. It's an amazing thing that, you know, when God puts on our heart to do something and share and help support people, we kind of think, isn't this exciting? Because God just kind of is always ahead of us. You give somebody $200 and somehow you come up with $300. I don't understand the math, but it works. And somehow when you begin to operate in that concept, you begin to realize that God yearns to bless those who have an open heart and an open hand and who are of generous soul. But you see, what happens when you're a layman, you cling to what you have, you end up losing not only what you have, but you end up with less than you had. And we find that the wicked, God stores up the treasures of the wicked, he said, to give them to the righteous. And that's what we find happens to Laban. In his wickedness, he ends up losing all that God wanted to bless him with. Well, let me talk for a moment about Jacob. I beat up Laban bad enough, and I've enjoyed it. But Jacob is often given a pretty bad rap because obviously he has some lapses of faith. But one of the things I love about this story is that He doesn't live up to his name as the trickster, as some have implied. In fact, years of being a victim, of his own sin, he really becomes victimized by the fact that God puts him into concert with a guy who is a better trickster than he. You know, in other words, if you're a cheat and you're a liar and a deceiver, God is going to bring you together with somebody who can out-trick, out-deceive, out-lie, out-cheat you. And you're going to have the opportunity to feel the pain of your own behavior. You know, if you have an unrepented sin in your life, God is going to do something that you're going to be exposed to the very thing you go, so you can feel what it's like to do what you do to other people. And that's exactly what we find with Jacob. God did with Jacob. Jacob is a liar. He's a tricker. He's a deceiver. What does God do? He puts him with a master deceiver. And he gets ripped off and wounded and battered by it. And I think it changed him. I think it changed him. Because when Laban gives him the offer to name his wages, Jacob by this time knows that Laban is not a man who can be trusted. It doesn't matter what they agree to. He'll find a way of changing it and getting around it. He does something that I think demonstrates that he is a man of faith. He begins, first of all, by acknowledging that all of the blessing you've received is not because of me, it's because of God. When he says, "The Lord has blessed you wherever I have been." It's God who has made you rich, Laban. Don't you understand that? It's not me. I'm not the lucky talisman that you wear around your neck. It's essentially saying, Laban, if you worship the Lord as I worship the Lord, you would be blessed too. But when he says to them, you know, hey, what shall I give you to get you to stay with me? Laban says, Jacob's proposal really seems too good to be true to Laban. He says, don't give me anything. But if you will do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks, watching over them. Let me go through your flocks and remove from them every speckled and spotted sheep, every dark-colored lamb, every spotted lamb, every speckled goat, and they will be my wages. And my honesty will testify to me in the future. Whenever you check on the wages you have paid me, any goat in my possession that is not speckled, spotted, or any lamb that is not dark-colored will be considered stolen. In other words, all I ask for are all the mottled-colored. I mean, if a goat or a sheep is white, it's yours. If it's not, it's mine. Now, when you read this, you go, well, that doesn't seem like such a bad deal. Well, you have to understand that dark-colored sheep or multicolored sheep and goats were viewed in those days as an omen of good fortune. Why? Because they were rare. You know how we say, well, he's the black sheep of the family. Well, what does that mean? There aren't very many black sheep in this world. Black sheep are kind of a recessive gene in the sheep world, you know. And when the black sheep comes out, you go, well, that's different. And the same thing was true here. When you had a multicolored, mottled-colored, discolored a black sheep or goat or something like that, that was a rare thing. So in a way, they interpret it as being, oh, look, this is an omen of good because it was so rare and so unusual. So what Jacob is saying is, listen, give me the rare ones. And, you know, I mean, Laban could look at this and go, I mean, he's all over this. He goes, agreed. Let it be as you have said. In other words, in his mind saying, this is great. Statistically speaking, this is the best bargain I've ever had going for me. But fortunately for Jacob, fortunately for people of faith, God doesn't work on the basis of percentages or statistics or probabilities or any of the rest. Laban operates in that time, that framework, being the kind of guy he was and not content to just leave the bargain in either the hands of statistics or probability. He can't quit being a cunning and scheming man. And so we read in verse 35, it says, the same day he, speaking of Laban, removed all the male goats that were streaked and spotted, and he takes them 3 days' journey away. In other words, when Jacob said, just give me the spotted, speckled, black, the odd ones, give them to me. He says, great deal. And then he tells his son, now you go over there and take all those and move them out of there so that all he has is white sheep, white goats. What's the plan? White sheep and goats, mating with white sheep and goats. How many spotted, speckled, and dark colored are going to come out of that? I mean, these guys didn't understand genetics, but they knew how to breed sheep and goats. And so basically Laban is going to, I'm going to not only do I have the odds in my favor, I'm going to stack the deck against Jacob so that there's no way he can touch my fortune. This is why I believe this is one of the brightest moments in Jacob's life. See, by taking the lower seat in much the same way that Abraham did with Lot. Remember how Abraham said to Lot, "You pick the best land, and whichever direction you go, I'll go the other way," which was kind of completely out of character of the times, because in those days, the head of the family, he was the one who chose the best part for himself. But instead, Abraham takes the lower seat to his younger nephew and says, "No, you have the first choice. You pick what's ever best." But we know the story. Who turned out on top? Abraham's allowing Lot to take the first choice blessed Abraham. Lot ended up losing everything, much like we find happened here. But where did this kind of inspiration come from? Well, we'll see it comes from God. I mean, make no mistakes about it. Jacob understood how the odds were stacked against him. But he had also seen how the Lord had been able to bless him by giving him a huge family. And he recognized the blessing of God had brought Laban, brought him through all this time of service to Laban. And now he believed that God would bless him once again, and he could cause the impossible to happen. What I really see it as is making room for God to do miracles in your life. Sometimes we're afraid to trust the path that God wants us to go down because we're saying, "Well, that can't work. If I do that, I'll lose everything." It's like tithing. So many people don't tithe. The vast majority of Christians don't tithe for one simple reason. They're convinced, "I can't afford to do this. If I begin to give that portion to the Lord, I can't pay my bills." But what they don't understand is you're denying God room in your life to show you what he can do. That's why he says in Malachi, "Prove me on this thing, test me in this thing, and see if I won't pour out a blessing that you can't receive." And so dogs, basically God saying, if I can colloquialize it in a very non-prophetic way, "I double dog dare you to tithe." You know, the bottom line, he's saying, it's the only time in all the Bible ever God says, "Test me, prove me." But essentially what he's saying, you will never see how I can bless you until you make room in your life for the blessing to come. And oftentimes, how do we make room in our life? It's by letting go of control. It's by simply saying, "Lord, I'll obey you, I'll trust you, I'll believe you, and I'll follow you." What we do find out is that's exactly what Jacob is doing. Jacob didn't figure this out on his own. In fact, he goes on later on in chapter 31, he explains to his wife that it's God who told him to do this. In fact, in chapter 31, verse 9, it says, "So God has taken away your father's livestock and has given it to me. In breeding season, I once had a dream in which I looked up and saw that the male goats mating with the flocks were streaked, speckled, and spotted, and the angel of the Lord came to me in a dream." And Jacob answered, and he said, "Jacob," and I answered, "Here I am." And he said, look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, or spotted. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel," where God appeared to him, "where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land." In other words, all of this happened because God revealed himself to him and said, "You are going to receive all the spotted, the speckled." So what he did, he went to Laban and said, "Give me all the spotted, the speckled, the dark, because God showed me that this is his plan. That is what he has for me." We don't find Jacob going, "But Lord, that's a cheesy deal. I mean, you give me this little limited number of sheep and goats. That's not fair." No, he just goes to him and said, "Listen, this is what I want. This is what God has promised to me." You see, often in trying to explain what Jacob does and how he succeeds, the tendency is to try to explain it as a result of his shrewdness and his cleverness and skillfulness, or even the result of some kind of primitive belief in the influencing genetics through what they call visual suggestion. In other words, by putting striped sticks in the water, it caused a visual suggestion that made them bear striped babies. Boy, if that works, obviously it doesn't work. And we know that's not how it works. In fact, one commentator said, "Jacob finds a way to outwit his father-in-law through prenatal conditioning of the flock by visual aids in conformance with universal folk beliefs." In other words, saying, "Well, you know, he believed that that's the way it worked. And, you know, that was primitive ways that a bunch of knuckle-dragging Neanderthals, they didn't know any better like we do today. But, you know, God blessed it anyway." Well, I think that misses it completely. Because Jacob explains his plans to his wife as being the result of a revelation that God had given to him. God told him what to do. And there's no indication that Jacob came up with this on his own through some clever plan. Rather, he's responding to a divine instruction, which I would suggest may not have made a whole lot of sense to him either. We read it and go, what is that all about? I got a feeling that Jacob thought, what is that all about? But Jacob is not being clever, he's being obedient. He's not being clever, he's being obedient. I do not think God has called us to be visionaries in the sense that we think up some great plan and go about implementing it. I remember for years I was, you know, read these church growth books and they talk about, well, first you have to become a visionary leader, you know, and I'd sit there and work at coming up with vision. Be visionary, you know, and of course, I always would present to my board this 7-point vision because, you know, that makes it godly. It's got 7 points. Never ever fulfilled any of the points, but it looked good. It was very impressive. One day in frustration saying, God, I keep on trying to come up with this vision, but it doesn't work. It suddenly occurred to me, the Lord just simply said, I'm the visionary. I have the vision. I'll reveal it to you. Just obey me. I haven't called you to be a visionary. I've called you to be an obedient servant. One of the simplest instructions any pastor is what Jesus gave to Peter. He said, Peter, feed my sheep. He says, if you love me, feed my sheep. That's all. That's the job description. If you love me, feed my sheep, tend my lambs. Just minister to them the things that will enable them to grow. That's all you need to do. Because one of the things that shepherds learn very quickly is that sheep have their own inherent growth system. Feed them, keep them healthy, protect them from threats. And you know what happens? They grow. And not only they grow, they reproduce. And the same thing is true about the people of God. Feed them, care for them, protect them from the damaging doctrines and things that can get to them. And what happens? They grow, and as they grow, what happens? They become reproductive. They begin to share their faith with other people. It's a very simple formula. You know, but sometimes I think we as pastors think it's our job to have all the babies. That'll ruin your figure real fast. You see, I think there's a very real danger here that we can become like Nebuchadnezzar, who after God had so richly blessed that man, he stood up and said, is this not great Babylon that I have built? And what followed? God humbled him and he became a mindless idiot for we're not sure how long. 7 seasons is what it says. And when he came out of it, he suddenly humbled himself and said, God has shown me it ain't me, babe. It was God. And I think there's a danger of that. We want to do great things. But when we look at what God does, that he is the visionary, what our job is to catch the vision, to obey it, to follow it, and then he fulfills it. Now, there is a part that we play in this. In a way, it comes when you look at Jacob. What he does is really confusing next. In verse 37, it says, Jacob, however, took fresh-cut branches from poplar and almond and plane trees and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. You know, every one of us who ever had a pocket knife did this at length. And placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so that they would directly be in front of the flocks when they came to drink. And when the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they made it in front of the branches. The only time that this seemed to have any benefit is, it says, when the flocks were in heat. You know, that they didn't look at these branches in the water and go, oh, suddenly I want to reproduce. You know, it doesn't work that way with goats and sheep. But when they were in heat, he put these in there, and this seemed to have an effect. The only thing that makes sense to me as to what he was doing was that it had some kind of mesmerizing effect upon the animals. In the same way that we talk about the deer and the headlight effect, that somehow maybe the way the water fluttered with these things and it just caused the light flashed off it or something, that they just kind of stared and stood in place so that the males were able to mate them. Because what he does next is basically direct the strong males towards the strong females to make sure that the strongest sheep would breed and that the weaker sheep, therefore, and goats would breed with each other and produce along these same lines. I mean, essentially, he follows this by engaging in what we call selective breeding, which produces, a flock of strong sheep that are multicolored and black and so forth. And over a very over the next 6 years, he ends up becoming far wealthier than Laban. In verse 43, it says, "In this way, the man grew exceedingly prosperous, came to own large flocks and maidservants and menservants and camels and donkeys." I mean, the guy just prospered like crazy. But it's important for us to recognize that the historian is not trying to suggest to us that Jacob somehow achieved this on his own. Rather, as I said, God gave him the vision, Jacob obeyed it, and God blessed. In fact, Paul puts it this way in writing to the Corinthians. He says, "I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow." One of the questions I get often asked by people is, so what is our part? You know, I know that God's will be done and God does everything. And so if God's will is going to be done, do we need to do anything? Can't we just sit around and wait and just watch God do it? We can be spectators. Well, I would prefer that, but that's not what Scripture teaches, you know. In other words, the just shall live by faith. You have to live. You have to walk by faith. In other words, you have to do something in response to God. And so when he says, for example, preaching the gospel, he says, go into all the world and preach the gospel. He doesn't say, stay home and think positive thoughts, you know, stay home and wish that the gospel is preached. He says, no, you have to actually move. You have to go and you have to open your mouth and you have to say something for the gospel to preach. And God says, if you'll do that, I'll honor that and this word will spread around the world. So that for whatever reasons, as Paul says in Romans 10, God has ordained that the gospel be preached through your and my mouth. Now, I don't think that's a particularly great plan, but nonetheless, that's what God has set up. And so the bottom line is God says, listen, if you will have enough faith to plant the seed and you'll have enough faith to water it, I promise you it will grow and it'll get an increase. The problem with many of us was simply saying, well, I don't know if the Lord will bless me if I share my faith. And what if I go and talk to them about the Lord and they reject it and they don't want to hear it? And we begin to talk ourselves out of ever sharing our faith. Yet God has already said, listen, if you do it, if you plant it and you water it, it will grow. I guarantee you, I will give the increase. But then he goes on to say, only God can make it grow. So when you begin to put it in perspective, you realize that God has called us. He talks about us being his partners. We're called into his fellowship. We are co-laborers with Christ is the term that Paul uses. That God has invited you to join with him in the work. In fact, I've told this story before, but it's to me is one of the best illustrations. I remember when my son Brian was just about 5 years of age and he'd watch me cutting the grass. And one day he came up to me and he said, Daddy, can I cut the grass? Well, you know, he could barely reach the handle on the mower, you know? So I thought, well, really, you know, you can't. But I said, sure, you can help me. And so what I did is I let him grab onto the handlebars and then I, you know, pushed the mower around the yard with him hanging on. Did he help me cut the grass? Not at all. He really slowed me down quite a bit. But when we were done, he was so proud of the job he had just accomplished. You see, I often see myself in relationship to God that way. I'll get done tonight after giving the message, and my wife who's watching my grandkids and couldn't be here tonight, she'll say, well, how did it go? And I say, oh, man, I was hot. You know, I mean, I was in the zone, and it was so powerful, you know. And I feel like God's sitting and saying, yeah, I let you hang on to the handlebars. You're just lucky I didn't cut your toes off, you know. It's just, then again, maybe he has. I don't know. But the bottom line is, you know, we sit there and say, oh, wow, that was so good. And yet all that God is saying is, look, I want you to show up. And if you show up, I'll do great things. If you'll just show up, I'll do great things. If you'll just obey me, if you just follow me, if you just turn out, I'll do wonderful things. And haven't we all had that experience on different levels of our life? I mean, how many of you don't have to raise your hands. But how many of you have been at home one evening and thought, Thursday night, gosh, you know, I'm tired, had a hard week. I just feel like vegging out, watching TV. And this small nagging voice in the back of your head saying, you really need to go to church. I know he's usually very boring and dry, but you need to go tonight. You know, he might say something of value. You know, just go. And this, you have this conversation in your brain, finally go, okay, I'll go. Make the dimwit feel good because I'm there, you know. And so you show up and you sit down and God hits you right where you've been struggling. And you go, oh, I'm so glad I was here tonight. You know, hopefully that's happened at least once in your life. Well, what's my point? What's this? Aren't I good? No. My point is this, that all that God wants to do is to get us to show up, and sometimes we miss out on so much because we just won't show up. When God tells us to share our faith with somebody, we just don't show up. When God tells us to go on a mission trip, we just don't show up. When God tells us to go to church, we just don't show up. When God tells us to invite somebody, we just don't. And the sad thing is, when you miss out on something, you know what that means? You miss out on something that you don't know you missed out on. All you're left with is kind of this vague sense that somehow I'm not getting out of this Christian life what I thought it was supposed to deliver. But I just can't figure out, why is it I just don't feel that joy of the Lord, that power of the Lord? Why don't I feel like God's using me? Why don't I feel close to God? Why don't, you know, I hear that guy up there, that, you know, that windbag up there going on about, God blesses you and God, you know, why doesn't he do that for me? And the answer may be really simple, because you never show up. You know, you never act upon the things that God tells you. You just sit back and say, well, you know, I'll just sit here and see if it happens all on its own. And then you wonder, why don't I have the joy? All I know is, you know, Jacob heard God say, gave him a vision. God gave him a vision and said, look, I'm going to give you all the spotted and I'm going to give you all the odd ones, you know. I'm going to give you all the oddballs. That's what's going to be your ministry. You get all the oddballs. You know, it's like a pastor. You get all the weirdos, you know. That's your ministry. You get all the weirdos, you know. And he just says, okay, here's what I want. I want all the weirdos. And suddenly they all show up, you know, because he asked for it. And well, let me tell you the truth. One of the things you begin to realize is you're all pretty weird. There is no such thing as non-weirdos. We are all weird. Every time I learn somebody's story, I just think, okay, I thought I was the only one that had that problem. Okay, this is a team thing, I see. But the fact of the matter is that God gives us what he has, knows is best for us. And God gives the increase when we're willing to just be obedient to him. It's such a simple thing. You know, sometimes I think there's a horrible redundancy to everything I say. And you probably feel that way sometimes too. But I feel like almost every time I preach a message, it always comes back to the same point. God can be trusted, so why don't you trust him? God can be trusted, so why don't you just trust him? Take a chance. Live on the edge for 5 minutes and discover what God can do. Because that's really what it comes down to. As we close tonight by sharing from the Lord's table, you know, that even in that, I see that message over and over again. Because as John said in his first letter, he said, herein is the love of God revealed. Here's the love of God manifest. And what is the example? He said, in that Christ died for you and me. Love is the key to trust. I trust people who love me because love does no harm to others. That's what Paul said. Love does no evil to others. When somebody loves you, they don't do something to hurt you. When somebody hurts you and said, but I love you, I'm so sorry for what I did, they're lying. You know, that was not love. If I love you, I'm not going to hurt you. If I hurt you, it's because I wasn't loving you when I did that. That's the truth. When I hurt my wife, it's because I wasn't loving her. I was thinking about me. I wasn't thinking about her. And so, you know, when God says this is God's love, what do we see? He died on the cross because he loved me. He gave up his life so that I might receive my life. And because of that love, I realize he can be trusted. So when I look at his word and he says, do this. And I go, okay, Lord, I will do what you've said. I'm gonna try to live my life as this tells me I should live my life. That I can trust in that because I know that he loves me and wouldn't tell me or ask me to do anything that wasn't for my own benefit and my own blessing. So that when we partake from the Lord's table, what we're supposed to be saying to God is, Lord, I trust you. I trust you with my life. I trust that you will do good for me. That I don't need to know what the future holds. In fact, quite honestly, most of the time, I don't really want to know because most of the time, it's not exactly what I anticipated. Brother, I just want to know, Lord, that you've got it covered when that stuff comes. I trust you for the future. I trust you for my life. And because of that, I can have peace in my heart and I can rest, knowing that you cause all things, as you said in your word, to work together for the good of those who love you and are called according to your purposes. Even when you're taking me through times of deep pain and disappointment, sorrow and failure, just like you did with Jacob, you do it for a reason. Because you want to change my character just like the way you began to change his character. Sometimes I have to drink my own poison to realize why it's poisonous, so that I'll stop serving it to others and think I'm clever. But instead I'll begin to realize there's a terrible thing I did. There's a terrible thing that I did. And that creates that humility and that brokenness in heart that makes us lose confidence in self and to begin to put our confidence in him and to trust him. And when we come to that place, then God says, you know, I can use you. I can bless you. I can work through your life. I can do great things in you and through you because you are in that attitude of heart. You've taken that posture of faith with me and you're letting me be God in the fullest sense in your life. I can't imagine why anybody wouldn't want to be in that place. I really can't. Because it's the most wonderful space to live because it's where God has called you to live. It's when you realize this is the suit I was made to wear. This fits me perfect. This is what I was designed for. What was I designed for? To follow him. Isn't it interesting that he can walk across the beach and it doesn't matter how big your foot is, every man's foot fits perfectly into his. It's custom designed. Every path is custom designed for you and for me. And what God has called me to do is simply follow him, and he'll lead me in the path. I'm going to ask the gentlemen to come forward, and they're going to distribute the elements so that we can share in communion together tonight. And as we do, and as they're doing what they do, I just want to encourage you to really make this a time of reflection in your life, that if perchance there's an area where you've been holding back from God, where you've been really afraid to just kind of trust him, that this is a time in which you can begin to really come before God honestly and say, Lord, I'm going to really kind of drive the stake into the ground right here. And from this day forward, God, I'm committing to follow you and to trust you in this area of my life. Whether it be an area where you have been afraid to step out, or maybe an area where you've kept on stepping in it, you know, the area of transgression. And you got stink on the bottom of your shoe because you walk around in this stuff. It doesn't matter what the issue is. This becomes an opportunity where you can kind of, you know, put a mark in the ground and say, God, I really surrender this to you. I'm going to trust you in this area of my life from this time forward. Some of you have already done that, but you're really struggling with the decision. You're thinking, did I make the right choice? Did I really make the right decision? Believe me, I have been there many, many times when you're between the posts and you're not sure you're going to make it from one to the other. And you're saying, God, did I make the right choice? Should I really have moved to Spokane? I mean, those kind of things come to your mind. And it's a wonderful thing to step back and say, God, I'm here because I trusted you. And I believe that you're going to get me to the other side of this. And I'm going to receive and enjoy the blessing that you have for me. A great time of affirmation.